Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Designer Danielle Trophy makes unique lampshades. They are gray, bowl-shaped, and they look really heavy, like they were made from poured concrete.
But when you touch them and feel them, they're super light, almost like as light as styrofoam, and spongy and soft to the touch, so it kind of feels like a lamb's ear. Some people have compared it to the rind of brie cheese.
So really that velvety feel?
Yeah, so velvet and soft to the touch, it almost invites you to touch the lampshade, which I think is a fun interaction for something that normally you wouldn't interact with in your living space.
Danielle doesn't really make these lampshades. She grows them.
From mushroom mycelium.
The root-like structure of mushrooms. And it only takes about 10 days. Danielle starts with a mold in the shape of a lampshade. She pats a mulch firmly into this form. The mulch is made from hemp, and it has a special ingredient.
It's already been inoculated with liquid mycelium, so it looks like small wood chips, and it's very brown. And over the course of these few days, it's going to slowly turn whiter and whiter and whiter. And you're not doing anything other than just letting it sit and grow in a room. There's no additional water or electricity that go into the production process. So you're letting nature do what it does best.
The mycelium spreads, forming a dense network of white filaments that binds everything together. Have you had some that didn't work out, where it sort of like formed half a lampshade and then just didn't keep going?
Yeah, of course. So it's a living organism, so you can't control everything. So I had this one that it was this large lampshade that I had left on accident for a lot longer period of time. And water had begun to drip in certain sections. And where it was getting this additional water, some fruiting bodies started to shoot off. So almost like spikes coming out of the outside of the shade. And so that's still one of my favorite ones. We call them Spike.
When the lampshades are done growing, they are dried and baked for a short time. Danielle says they are durable and sturdy, but also completely biodegradable. That's one of the reasons why mycelium is becoming increasingly popular as a material.
There's more and more innovation happening every day. People are using it to create leather for the fashion industry. They're creating acoustic tiles because the material has acoustical properties.
It's also being used for insulation and packaging. It's really versatile. But when it comes to the fungi kingdom, it's just one small part of the possibilities. I think of fungi as the Swiss Army knife of nature. They have so many moves and functions. They can decompose matter, they can build things or hold them together, they are edible and bring us some of our favorite foods. Yet sometimes they're poisonous. And we're really just beginning to understand all of the things fungi do and are capable of. On today's episode, the role of fungi in nature, medicine, and our lives. Paul Stamets has been singing the praises of fungi for decades. He's one of the pioneers in the field of mycology. He was just a little boy when he discovered his first great use for mushrooms as weapons.
The summer rains would come and these puffball mushrooms would show up and in the yard, and I would pelt my twin brother with puffballs because they're like little missiles.
Soon, Paul realized that these little missiles had so much more to offer.
I was amazed at how quickly they would come up and disappear. And I think that speaks to why mushrooms are so mysterious. They come up very, very quickly, and most mushrooms disappear in about 5 days. So our experiential window is very limited. And to find something that can feed you, that can kill you, that can send you on a spiritual journey, or that can heal you, something so potent and yet so ephemeral,
and also, Paul says, so unappreciated. He began to examine the role fungi play in the ecosystem, how they interact with other organisms. He didn't study this in college. He's self-taught. He wrote books on the topic and built a whole business around all things fungi and their fruiting bodies, mushrooms.
Mushrooms are like the fruit of the fungus, like an apple is the fruit of a tree. The mycelium is the root-like structure that gives rise to the fruit body of the mushrooms, just like a tree has roots and gives rise to a fruit body, an apple. So as a result, mushrooms tend to be very succulent, and they attract insects and humans and animals, and they kind of beguile and trick us into spreading their spores.
How so?
Because they're edible, they're fragrant, they're delicious, they're mysterious, they're beautiful.
But fungi are so much more than the beautiful mushrooms that pop up.
They're the molecular decomposers of nature. They break down plant and animal material, and they dismantle them. This is going to show my age a little bit, but they're like little Pac-Mans that go around the ecosystem.
Paul Stamets has inspired a whole new generation of fungi enthusiasts and researchers, among them English biologist Merlin Sheldrake. Merlin was also drawn to the subject at a young age.
When I was a child, I would carry buckets of kitchen waste into the garden and tip them on the compost heap and help my father, a few months later, shovel out soil and put them on the flower beds. Or I'd watch blocks of wood transform into soil, piles of leaves. And it was explained to me that these transformations are possible because of the activity of invisibly small organisms. And fungi were some of the organisms that formed part of these orchestras of brilliant decomposers. And I became fascinated by their lives and how they could have such enormous power, but remain out of sight.
It was this invisible power of fungi that captured Merlin's attention.
Without their decomposition, the world would be piled miles high in the dead bodies of animals and plants. And so we really live and breathe in the space that fungal decomposition leaves behind.
The more Merlin learned, the more he appreciated this vast universe with over 140,000 known species.
Fungi are a kingdom of life, which is as broad and busy a category as animals or plants. But they're neither animals and they're neither plants. They are their own way of life that share some similarities to animals in the sense that they have to find food in the world and they can't photosynthesize. But they share some characteristics with plants in the sense that they tend to grow places rather than go places. They don't have muscles and can't propel themselves around as we do.
It seems like fungi have a certain kind of intelligence, but it's hard to put your finger on what they are. It's sometimes almost like they remain unseen to us in so many ways.
Yes, their lives are remote from us because they live so embedded in their food. Most fungi live most of their lives as these networks, these branching, fusing networks of tubular cells, which are constantly remodeling themselves. They have no fixed shape. They can thicken in one direction and prune themselves back from another direction. So there's a kind of formlessness. It's like, you know, asking what shape a fungal network is. It's like asking what shape water is. It depends where the fungal network is growing, around who is it growing, and what time of year is it growing. But these networks themselves have a remarkable abilities to solve problems. Mycelial networks are bathed in a rich field of sensory information, gravity, light, temperature, all sorts of other stimuli that they're sensitive to. And they're able to integrate these various different sources of sensory information and integrate them and decide on suitable courses of action, whether that be digesting something over here, transporting some type of substance across its rambling, sprawling body several meters to somewhere over there, whether to interact in a certain way with this type of bacteria or that type of bacteria. They're really remarkable, fluid sensing bodies.
Fungi can also communicate between these networks and can transfer information.
There's chemical signals which can pass through the network, or chemical signals that can travel in the air, volatile signals. Also, flow itself. There are oscillations, changes in direction of flow and pressure in these networks that can transmit information. And also, in some species, it seems that they're able to use electrical activity to transmit information using waves of electrical activity, analogous to the waves of electrical activity that travel in our own neurons, in our own nervous systems.
Yeah, I was just going to say that sounds like nerve cells almost.
Yes, our nervous systems are fantastically complex networks of electrically excitable cells that grow from their tips. And many fungal networks are fantastically complicated networks of electrically excitable cells that grow from their tips. And so, you know, there is a superficial resemblance between these different types of network.
Does it seem strange how much we have underestimated this amazing thing right under our feet? I mean, when you start really digging into what fungal networks are capable of and how complicated they are, it just seems amazing that we haven't caught on to this sooner or gotten more involved in understanding it.
It is amazing. I think it's very humbling, and it reminds us how much we have passed over in our efforts in modern scientific systems to reduce and break down the living world into understandable parts, and how easy it is for us to miss really very basic and important facets of the living world in which we are embedded. I think it's important to feel that humility. I think it's important to feel the magnitude of what we don't know, of what we're yet to understand. So that's one of the reasons I find fungi fun to study. They give me a sense of wonder and of humility and of excitement of how much there is to know. And it's always surprising, you know, it's always surprising studying fungi. It's always surprising to find out something that seems so basic, so fundamental.
If I think about myself sitting in the studio right now, there are, you know, no mushrooms here, obviously, but I would assume there are lots of fungi around me, inside of me. Describe where I might find them if I were to look for them within myself right now.
So there'll be lots of yeasts in the air. There'll be yeast on the surfaces of your body, on the surfaces of the furniture and the objects around you. There'll be tiny little mycelial networks, different types of very small fungi living on specks of house dust, possibly living on other surfaces of your body and in your clothes. There'll be other types of fungi that live inside you, in your digestive system and in your digestive tracts, that help you digest food and regulate your internal systems, in which will interact with all the bacteria that live in and on you. There could well be decomposing fungi in and around the cavities of the room that you're in the building, and there'll be fungi living in and on any plant material that you have, any foodstuffs, because all plants depend on fungi that live in and around their roots, but also in and around their leaves and their shoots.
Sometimes fungi cause big problems, especially when conditions allow them to take over. They can turn food into slimy mold, make plants wilt with disease, and cause major health issues in humans.
Although I should add that this is in a great minority of cases in the fungal world, and it's perhaps one of the reasons why fungi have historically been feared or disregarded or treated with revulsion.
I guess we don't like to think of, you know, fungi living inside of us, and sometimes I guess they become problematic, but for the most part, it's just what happens inside of humans, right?
Yeah, it's what happens inside of most organisms. Mm-hmm. You know, these big creatures like ourselves are planets with respect to smaller creatures. Far from it being some strange and disconcerting fact, it's just a basic biological reality. And I think it says something about the way that we've decided to think about the living world and our place in it, that we're sometimes perturbed by that. What does it tell us about the way we've decided to separate ourselves from the living world of which we are inextricably embedded? That we find it freaky or strange that we are part bacteria, part fungus in some way.
I remember when I was first reading a lot about the microbiome, and then there was a lot of research coming out about how the microbiome can potentially affect our mood or our well-being. And then I thought, wow, there's so much more microbiome than there is me. And then I started thinking, well, what is me? Like, which part of who I think I am is me, and which part is this mass of microbiome? So it is a really interesting thought to wonder what you are made up of.
You know, I totally agree. I think this confusion is thoroughly healthy. And it's an example of the way that fungi and other microbes can invite us to question some of these well-worn categories that we use to organize our lives and societies, these categories of independence and autonomy and individuality and intelligence. And when we start to ask those questions, when these categories start to become questions rather than answers known in advance, I think we're led into all sorts of new relationships, new felt relationships with the other lives that surround us. And I think that can really do us some good.
That's biologist Merlin Sheldrake. He studies fungal networks, and his book is called Entangled Life: How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures. Fungi have been used in medicine for centuries. There's penicillin, of course, but also many more fungus-based treatments, from drugs that lower cholesterol to treatments for cancer. And now there is potentially a new contender, one that was discovered by accident, by desperate people looking for a cure for COVID-related anosmia or smell loss. Researchers estimate that hundreds of thousands of Americans have lost their sense of smell for 6 months or longer after going through COVID. One of them was Dustin, who asked us to just use his first name. His sense of smell disappeared early on in his illness.
You start realizing that you can't smell things that you normally would.
The coffee his wife made in the mornings, the wine they usually drank with dinner, even home didn't smell like home anymore. And this persisted even after the other symptoms had long subsided. His sense of smell seemed just gone.
This is a bummer, it's sad. And then you try and snap yourself out of it by being like, it's not that bad, you could be in the hospital. You know, you could have died from this.
But still, this felt like a big loss. It stole so much joy out of his life. Doctors didn't have much to offer in terms of treatments. Maybe smell training would help, where you sniff powerful scents to try to retrain your sense of smell. Instead, Dustin looked around online, and he came across the idea that magic mushrooms could help cure anosmia.
I had read somewhere that they change your brain activity, but then they also have an impact on your olfactory system, which is responsible for the sense of smell. I really didn't go too deep into it. I kind of was just like, oh, that's good enough for me. Like, if it has some sort of scientific connection, I'm willing to roll the dice and try it.
And roll the dice he did. Liz Tong picks up the story from here.
How does a responsible, married, 30-something guy organize his first magic mushroom trip in, 17 years? For Dustin, it started with reaching out to his friends.
You know, all my, connections from when I was younger, you know, are gone or either don't partake in those types of things anymore. But I happen to be friends with a tattoo artist. And so tattoo artists know a lot of people. And he happened to be like, oh yeah, I happen to have something, you know, laying around.
Dustin got his hands on $2,000. Not as much as he wanted, but enough for a decent dose. Having taken mushrooms before, he knew the importance of preparation.
Obviously, set and setting is the most important thing.
Dustin decided to set up in the office/spare room in his and his wife's apartment.
It's kind of just where you can kind of tuck yourself away a little bit. I've got all my music and stuff in there.
He had his wife serving as his trip sitter in the next room, food and drinks in case he got peckish, and the finishing touch, a pair of headphones and sunglasses. A tip he'd gotten from Michael Pollan's book on psychedelics, How to Change Your Mind. The final step was actually taking the mushrooms. He'd read up on that too.
I tried the lemon technique, and it just basically squeezed out a lemon into a glass, and then I ground everything up, put it in there. I think I mixed a little bit of orange juice in there and just down the hatch.
So Dustin was sitting around listening to records, waiting for something to happen, when suddenly it hit.
I started to feel the fuzzies. Within an hour, I'm like, okay, I'm starting to get, you know, my visual fields are starting to get tracers or however you want it. It's just really a unique sensation. I've never experienced anything else like it. And then by like hour and a half, 2 hours in, I was like fully into it.
And then, without warning, it happened.
It was just like, hit me in the face. That like my own body odor was just like very pronounced. And I was like, what the hell is going on? Like, I smell awful. And then I was like, oh my God, I can smell.
Even in the midst of his psychedelic trip, Dustin knew how big this was. He says the depth of the smell was incredible. Like, if smells were represented by colors, he could see the whole rainbow and then some.
And so I kind of started freaking out with like joy. Like, I was just like overjoyed, you know? So my wife had heard me from the other room and she's like, what's going on? I was like, oh my God, I smell awful. Like, this is amazing.
Dustin started running around the apartment to smell things. His wife tossed him an orange.
Peeled it, bit into it, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I can taste it, like really taste it.
Same for the enchiladas they ate that night for dinner.
I could taste the individual ingredients in there, right? I could distinguish the tortilla versus the sauce versus the kind of flavorless chicken, but like I could taste that again. And that was the first time I had that for a really long time. So it was a real, I mean, it's not anything I wish on anybody to lose their sense of smell, but to lose it and then have it come back that abruptly was a really, it was a special experience.
Dustin ended up posting about his experience on Reddit. And he says the biggest question he got from other people was, okay, so it worked, but did it last? For the most part, Dustin says the answer is yes. That first day, his sense of smell was fully back. He estimates like 95 to 100%. Since then, it's varied from day to day, though he says it hasn't dipped lower than 90%.
So there is part of me that's also curious to, like, you know, give it a second shot and see, is this like a compounding benefit? Is it kind of gets you to a level and that's all they can do for you?
As you might imagine, success stories like Dustin's have garnered their own little cult followings online, where thousands of people, if not more, are looking for answers, desperate to regain their sense of smell. I wanted to find out if there's any way this could possibly be true. Could magic mushrooms really be a cure for anosmia? A condition, by the way, that's continued to stump doctors and researchers around the world. And if it does work, how does it work? What's the mechanism? I should warn you from the outset that answering these questions ended up being a lot more complicated than I thought. Let's just say the research on COVID-related smell loss is still developing, and there are a lot more questions than answers at this point. I'll start with the most popular explanation I came across, made not by experts, by the way, but by Redditors commenting on stories like Dustin's. A while back, some research came out suggesting that psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, can cause neurons to regenerate, a process called neurogenesis. Now, neurons are the workhorses of our olfactory systems. They live in our nasal cavities, and their job is to grab onto odor molecules and send info about them to the brain. So the idea here is that maybe COVID is attacking or wiping out those neurons, and what the shrooms are doing is helping them grow back. This isn't a brand new idea. Even before COVID, there were researchers focused on neurogenesis as a potential fix for anosmia. So I decided to reach out to one of them, Brad Goldstein. He's an otolaryngologist, or ear, nose, and throat doc, who's been studying post-COVID anosmia and also happens to be an expert on neurogenesis. So does it seem at all plausible to you that shrooms could be helping treat people's anosmia by causing those olfactory neurons to regenerate?
You know, I guess I have to choose my words carefully here, right? But no, I guess I would question whether neurogenesis is sort of the mechanism or not. I would say a lot more research might need to happen before we can jump to that conclusion.
That's his nice way of saying, yeah, probably not. For one thing, it turns out the evidence that psilocybin causes neurons to regenerate is pretty thin. Plus, Brad told me it would probably take weeks of neurogenesis to reverse anosmia, not an afternoon of tripping. So I asked Brad why he thinks shrooms could be restoring people's sense of smell. Brad clearly had his doubts that this was possible at all. But he said if it was possible, it could come down to how psilocybin affects the brain. See, the way magic mushrooms create their psychedelic effects is by modulating certain serotonin receptors.
Turn up or turn down or adjust or, you know, change how that signal is being, you know, received or transmitted from one cell to another cell.
And serotonin may be involved in some of the brain regions that process smells. It's one of the neurotransmitters in the brain that helps neurons send messages to one another. including potentially the signals that Carrie smells.
Theoretically, if you were turning up serotonin signals and some of those circuits are using serotonin, then somebody could have an olfactory perception change as a downstream effect of that.
That idea resonated with the next researcher I talked to, Chris von Bartelt. He's a professor of physiology and cell biology at the University of Nevada School of Medicine. And like Brad, Chris has also been studying COVID-related anosmia. I asked him what he thinks could be going on.
Psilocybin is known to have changes in perception. And so let's say you have COVID, you lost your sense of smell. So let's say for weeks or even months, there has been no activity in your olfactory nerve. And so the parts of the brain that receive normally this information, they notice that, well, there's nothing coming in.
It's kind of like when your computer goes to sleep.
So maybe what the psychedelic mushrooms do is to basically kind of like hit a reset button.
In other words, and Chris emphasized this is a total guess, but maybe the psilocybin is waking up the part of the brain that processes smells. But there's an issue with these explanations. They're both centered on the brain. And Brad Goldstein, the ear, nose, and throat doc I talked to, told me that based on the latest research, that's not where the problem is.
I think it's pretty clear that the damage from this virus is almost certainly in the nose, at the olfactory epithelium of the nose. I think there's very little evidence that this virus directly enters the brain or damages the brain or neurons directly. Actually, it looks like it infects other cells in the epithelium, such as the supporting cells.
The takeaway here: the way COVID shuts down smell isn't by directly infecting our olfactory neurons or our brains, but rather by messing with our actual smelling apparatus. To put it in super simple terms, COVID's attacking our noses, not our brains. What that means, Brad says, is that it's less likely that whatever psilocybin is doing to the brain is actually having an effect on the root cause of post-COVID anosmia. Though he did add that something else could be going on, something that sort of bent my brain into a pretzel.
So I know we're trying to reconcile, okay, how does a drug that affects brain chemistry affecting olfactory perception if the damage isn't necessarily in that region of the brain? Well, it's because it's affecting brain chemistry, and if that brain region is processing smell perceptions or smell, memories or smell something, it could give a person an effect. Whether that's like a purely a hallucination or an augmentation of, some signaling that's happening, I don't know.
So, could Dustin have actually been hallucinating the smell of that orange, or himself? For my final expert opinion, I turn to Fred Barrett, a neuroscientist who serves as the associate director of the Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research, one of the world's leading research centers focused on psychedelics.
The idea that psychedelics could treat anosmia is frankly fascinating to me. I think there's a story, there's a possible explanation for that.
We talked for a while about all the cool and crazy things shrooms can do to our perception. So I was kind of expecting Fred to offer the most mind-blowing theory of all. As it turns out, Fred did have a novel new idea, though it didn't have anything to do with shrooms' psychedelic powers. He told me that recently, new research has been coming out showing that under the right circumstances, psychedelics have anti-inflammatory properties, which leads us to Fred's guess about what's going on.
Hear me out for a second. My understanding of anosmia in the case of coronavirus is due to an inflammation of the olfactory epithelium and the olfactory nerves that connect with the olfactory bulb and go back. And so, to the degree that the sensory organ essentially is inflamed, that can essentially cut off signaling from the nose back to the brain. If that's the case, and if psychedelics have an anti-inflammatory effect, it stands to reason that, adding an anti-inflammatory to your body would ameliorate the effects of an inflammation. And if people are recovering from anosmia through psychedelic use, that briefly would be my guess as to what might be happening.
Or, Fred said, it could be something much less exciting than that, a possibility that the other scientists I talked to had brought up too. Remember the old rule of science: correlation is not causation.
Can I offer an alternative hypothesis here? That, like, over the hundreds and of thousands and millions of people who have gotten COVID, and the subset of those folks who have had anosmia, and the subset of folks who have anosmia that take psychedelics, it may just be that a dozen people took a psychedelic right about the time they were going to recover from anosmia to begin with. Right? I mean, is that, I think that at least needs to be entertained as a possibility.
Fred was also careful to point out that there are dangers to shrooms, which is why their studies are so highly controlled. They can elevate heart rate and blood pressure, and there are also many, many people who've experienced bad trips that left them psychologically scarred for years to come. All of the experts I talked to warned against people trying to treat themselves using shrooms or any other uncontrolled substance. Instead, Brad, the ear, nose, and throat doc, urged people to keep their ears pricked up for new treatments.
Again, I'm optimistic that I think we may see some really new things come out before too long that hopefully will really be helpful. But it's amazing how much, you know, we've learned about the olfactory system, but how little has directly translated into new treatments. And that's really what motivates me. I mean, I think right now we really do need to figure out ways to translate all of this knowledge into therapies and quickly.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up, a crash course on cooking mushrooms.
The trick is with a lot of these is not to salt them early.
And a look at growing them yourself.
When you have the garden giant in your garden, not only are you growing these delicious, huge mushrooms, they're Godzilla mushrooms, they're huge, up to 5 pounds a specimen. And the garden giant becomes resident in the ecosystem for years thereafter.
That's next on The Pulse.
The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about fungi and the many roles they play in nature and in our lives. Earlier on, we heard from one of the pioneers in the field of fungi research, mycologist and mushroom entrepreneur Paul Stamets. I got to interview him a few years ago, and he came to the studio wearing a hat made from mycelium and carrying a huge mushroom, a giant wood conch.
It's really hard. It sounds like wood, feels like wood. Looks like a giant beehive, but solid, like wood. And these are annual growth rings. And each year, there's an annual growth ring, and just like the tree rings grow. And
this is like 2 foot almost.
Yeah, it's about 2 feet tall. This weighs about 40 pounds. TSA broke it one time going through the airport. I said, why did you break my wood conch? And they said, we wanted to see what's inside of it. I said, it's a mushroom. It's a mushroom's inside of it, you know? And plus, it's a rare species. And so I glued it back together. So it travels with me. It's my best buddy.
One of the things we talked about is growing edible mushrooms. Paul's company, Fungi Perfecti, sells growing supplies online. Paul, sometimes the idea of growing mushrooms, it seems almost a little bit like sea monkeys, you know, it looks so cool. But then is it really going to happen? Can I really do that? Is it going to work out if I try to grow mushrooms? You can do it, right?
Yeah, that's been the greatest challenge. And I'm very happy to say after 30 years of many failures and a few successes, now we're very successful in teaching people how to grow mushrooms in their backyard. And my two favorite mushrooms to grow, one is called the Garden Giant. And the garden giant can grow in your backyard. It's a friendly fungus with plants. So when you have the garden giant in your garden, not only are you growing these delicious, huge mushrooms, they're Godzilla mushrooms. They're huge, up to 5 pounds a specimen, and the garden giant becomes resident in the ecosystem for years thereafter. So really, you can plant it once, and it'll kind of run around your property, and whatever there's wood chips and straw, it'll break those down into rich soil. It benefits the plants because now you have better soil to grow in.
And what do they look like?
It's called, also called the red cap or the burgundy cap. They're burgundy red. They're beautiful, like a cobblestone, so they first come up. And then they enlarge from a small button. These buttons are huge, the size of your fist when they come up. But they get up to 2-3 feet in diameter in 5 days. And so we advise people not to put them in the front yard because cars will screech to a stop if they see these giant mushrooms in your front yard. So put them in your backyard because mushroom hunters are notorious for ignoring all property boundaries.
That sounds like a good one to start with if you have very little experience.
Right.
But I'm sure people want, you know, the kind of dream mushrooms, the chanterelle and all those things. Can we grow those too?
Chanterelles are mycorrhizal fungi. They require the roots of trees, and it takes many, many years before you have a chanterelle growing if you plant a tree. But the shiitake mushrooms are my personal favorite. And you can grow those on oak logs or cottonwood or aspen. You get little mycelial pellets and called plug spawn, and you drill a hole, and you put the plug spawn in the hole, and you whack it. There's some sort of primeval satisfaction about putting a little plug in a hole and hitting it with a hammer. But once you do about 30 of those plugs per log, about 3 feet long, 4 to 6 inches in diameter, and you set it in the shade. And typically a year later, then these gourmet shiitake mushrooms come out of the logs. They'll come out 2 or 3 times a year over about 5 to 10 years. So it's a wonderful thing to have in the garden.
A lot of times gardeners view mushrooms a bit like enemies. There are mushrooms we can't eat. They crop up everywhere in the garden where we don't want them to. How should we treat those, and what's your take on those?
That's a wonderful question. It speaks to what we call mycophobia, the irrational fear of fungi, because you don't understand them. But classically, and I'll go out on a limb here and say 99% of the mushrooms that you see growing in the garden are helpful, and they're a sign that the ecosystem's alive, it's decomposing. And in doing so, your garden will be healthier, your yard will be healthier. You know, we're not talking about golf courses here. You know, we're talking about naturescapes that are sustainable. And if you bring in more wood chips every year, this is what they do. And those wood chips, and anyone had a pile of wood chips, you can see it in 3 years, it becomes soil. How does it become soil? Well, the mushroom-forming fungi break down the wood chips and create soil. So by bringing in the wood chips, replenishing the carbon in your soil, you make the soil healthier, and you need the fungi in there to do that for you.
Paul Stamets is a mycologist and mushroom entrepreneur. He's written several books, among them Mycelium Running, How Mushrooms Can Help Save the World. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. We've talked so much about fungi. It's time to cook and eat some of them, isn't it? For that purpose, I went to Veg Restaurant in Philadelphia. It's a fine dining destination that's won praise from national restaurant critics across the country, and a place that serves vegan cuisine. So mushrooms are a really important part of the menu.
Oh, mushrooms are just, they're the meat of the vegetable world.
That's chef and owner Rich Landau.
Now, you know, if you're not going to do fake meats like everyone's doing these days, and if you're not going to do, a lot of seitan and tofu, we do a little tofu, you got to go back to the mushrooms. They are the meat. It's not just the texture, it's the flavor too. We powder a lot of mushrooms, porcinis and shiitakes. When they're dried, you can kind of put them in a coffee mill and make this powder to flavor your stocks and your sauces. So you get this beautiful foundation of this, all these earthy, chocolatey tones, just so much depth. They add so much depth to your sauce. So they're phenomenal with all their flavor.
When Rich first started cooking professionally, mushrooms were still a bit of a new frontier in terms of what was available. Portobellos were a rarity.
Oh, man, I think I saw my first portobello in 1992, and I was blown away. I was like, you've got to be kidding me. That's a mushroom? That is a piece of steak. And they just did a sandwich with it, and I thought it was so interesting. Now, back then, they were like $12 a pound, and you couldn't even get them. They were this very, very specific boutique item. So imagine that, a portobello mushroom being something impossible to find, and then you pay a fortune for it, but that was the 90s, and now they're just, you can get them at Applebee's now.
Rich told me that learning how to cook with different mushrooms takes time, and you have to really get to know them.
The important thing is to listen to them. Not literally, but, you know, listen to them. And they'll tell you, for instance, you have like royal trumpet mushrooms. You could shred these with a fork or by hand, and they have this kind of this consistency like shredded meat. Portobellos are, put them on the grill. If you cook them right, they become very steak-like. The trick is with a lot of these is not to salt them early. A lot of people make that mistake. They season mushrooms way too soon in the pan. What happens when you salt something? All the water goes into the pan, and now you have a big old soggy mess.
Ah, so how have you learned to work with these different mushrooms? Because it almost sounds like each of them has their own characteristics, and it's not like mushroom, this is how you make them.
Oh, it's really just listening to them, looking at them, and some people go into a dish with a certain concept or idea in mind, and they force whatever the concept they have into their ingredients. I do it completely opposite. I look at the vegetables I'm working with and let them tell me what they can do and what they can't do. For instance, if you take a mushroom like a shiitake, it's a very dry mushroom. There's not a lot of water in it at all. These grill up beautifully. If you get the shiitakes that are big enough, they grill beautifully and take on the most incredible flavor on the grill. A lot of people just throw shiitakes into a soup, and I don't think they belong in there. I think their texture lends themselves to being grilled. Oyster mushrooms are all feathery and light. They need to be seared. They should get really crispy. Things like that, just listening to what the mushrooms can and can't do.
He brought out a big, feathery, grayish mushroom to prepare.
So these are maitake mushrooms, also known as hen of the woods. So they grow in these clusters. They have this very defined base to them. And out from that grows all these little feathery type of growths here, almost like a flower. Now, the beauty of this is that when you sear them, the stem becomes very meaty, almost like a portobello. It's like kind of steak knife food. And then these feathery little shoots it has, get really crispy. And it's just such a beautiful effect.
We head into the kitchen to cook this mushroom. The gas range is going.
So what kind of pan are you using here?
So this is a stainless steel pan. These are great for everyday cooking. If you want to really get fancy, cast iron is absolutely the way to go. You get so much flavor. A wok is great. The key to all these, really high heat. Everyone thinks it's the pan that's nonstick. It's the heat that counts the most. So I'm just really heating this pan up a lot. I'm letting that fire go in that pan. It's dry, there's nothing in it. And then when it's time, that's when I'll add a little bit of oil.
Whew, so that is really hot right now. Okay,
It's really hot. So we're gonna add a little bit of oil. So I'm gonna break these apart, and you can see that we have just this kind of nice plank of mushroom here. It's got a good bit of stem on it and a lot of the feathery parts.
Okay.
Just lay this down in the pan.
See, now I want to put salt on it, but no salt.
I know, the temptation is there to salt the mushrooms. Now, there's another temptation that's here. Your temptation is to start tossing these mushrooms around. The best thing you can do for them is just let them be. Let them get that sear. If I lift that up and toss it now, it's just going to mess up this great kind of color that we're going to get.
When Rich flips the mushroom, it's perfectly seared and it looks crispy. The other side is cooked after another minute or so. Only then does Rich finally sprinkle some salt on the mushroom. He grinds some fresh pepper and drizzles a bit of olive oil over it.
To serve this, real simply, as an appetizer, I just want a piece of crusty bread. That's all I want in the world.
That's Rich Landau. He's the chef at Veg Restaurant, which he owns with his wife, Kate Jacoby. They've written several cookbooks, among them Veg, 100 plates, large and small, that place vegetables in the spotlight.
Oh, wow. That is so good. It has a little crust on it. And it's so delicate. It's so delicious.
This is The Pulse. We're talking about fungi. Our last story is about a woman who fell in love with mushrooms as a child. And now she spends a lot of her free time showcasing their beauty and versatility. Nicole Curry has this profile.
Barbara Batikova loves mushrooms, so much so that she is known as Fungi Woman online. She hosts a popular website and Instagram account all about mushrooms. Barbara says at first she was mostly interested in the visual aspects.
It really, for me, was about the photography more than anything. Sort of sharing the visual beauty and the colors and the variety of mushrooms that I found on my walks. But slowly I figured out that providing tips about the identification for a particular mushroom or about the ecology, where they grow, how they grow, or about their particular benefits.
Barbara lives in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania now, but she grew up in the Czech Republic, where foraging for mushrooms is just something that you do.
They often say that for Czechs, it's almost a national sport.
Barbara and her family would gather at their 200-year-old summer house in South Bohemia on the weekends. They'd spend hours planting flower beds, cleaning up the two barns on the property, and fixing up the house.
Then when we weren't working, when mushroom season started, we would go into the woods and forage for mushrooms. I would drag my brother into the woods with me. I think I was about 13. My brother was about 7. And it was prime mushroom season. And we took these woven baskets that were really meant for picking potatoes. And we would spend hours and hours picking king bolete, also known as the porcini mushroom, around the woods because there were so many of them.
The more they foraged, the more they learned.
My grandma would show me these mushrooms and I would slowly learn their names. And I started to, you know where they grew, what were the spots to go for specific mushrooms. And for example, my grandfather that I've actually never met, but I know through stories that when he would go foraging, he would just go directly to these spots because sort of over time you learn where some mushrooms grow. And so you just go to your sure spot to sort of check on them. And so he wouldn't just wander around the woods. Going foraging with my family was sort of a pastime. It was a way to connect with ourselves, to have a good time, and also to connect to the area that we were living in.
And discovering new mushrooms is a special part of foraging for Barbara. She told us about finding what is now her favorite mushroom, the Clethrus archeri,
commonly known as the octopus stinkhorn or devil's fingers.
Her mom discovered it growing in the woods behind their summer house. She sent pictures.
It is one of the weirdest looking fungi out there. It starts as an egg-shaped structure that eventually expands to a starfish-like structure with 4 to 7 elongated slender arms that emanate from the center of the mushroom. These arms then unfold to reveal a pinkish-red interior that is covered with a dark olive-green goo. And this goo contains the spores, and it smells like rotting flesh. And this smell attracts the flies that then spread these spores.
A few months later, Barbara got to see it for herself. It was beautiful, and
It really does stink.
That's Barbara Batikova. You can find her online as Fungi Woman. Nicole Curry reported the story. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can check us out wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Nicole Curry is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund, PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.